Welcome to Dominate for Two, a War Machine and Hordes podcast.
I'm Alex.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Benjamin.
And I'm also Alex.
This episode, we're going to discuss both widgets and terrain on a table. So we talked about pre-measuring and some other things in a previous episode, but this time we're going to actually just talk about the actuality of widgets and sort of some sportsmanlike things versus unsportsmanlike use of the widgets.
Actually, I'd just like to interject here that I was completely right about pre-measuring. It's one of the things that people love most, I would say, about the edition change.
They love, and sometimes they also hate it at the same time.
But I think everyone, when they're playing their turn, everyone loves pre-measuring for all of what we talked about.
Oh, yeah. It makes the game smoother. You can figure out the plan you want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I was on board with that within like 5 minutes of actually figuring out how
it was going to happen. It just makes the game so much more fair.
Yeah, it's just so much faster. Yeah. And I will say for tournament play, I think that the pre-measuring has given more credence to the play and less cheating than anything else they could have done, because I've had many complaints over the years about watching people move very sloppily and in ways that were very much cheating to move forward. And pre-measuring has eliminated that factor for the most part.
I can also see where there's a little bit of a negative connotation on some pre-measuring in regards to, like, some people will pre-measure the entire thing before their clock starts at times. Like, I've heard some cases of this, but I haven't really seen it in, like, major competitive
where they'll lay down a bunch of tokens for this is what my turn one move is going to be. They'll lay it down off the clock, and then you'll determine table sides, and then they'll just place their models, like, measure it. Like,
oh, yeah. Wait a second. That doesn't sound legal at all.
Well, technically it is, because it's just pre-measuring. It doesn't tell you when you can pre-measure.
Well, no, but I mean...
Yeah, I've never seen that.
By pre-measuring a spot, you would have had to have deployed, and you had to deploy on the clock.
So at least one of the reactions I've heard to that is, you know, you can measure anything you want before the game starts, including distance between, like, terrain pieces, where killbox is, any number of things before the clock actually starts. This is inclusive of pre-measuring. The response I've seen to this is that the first player is allowed, or your opponent is allowed at some phase to say, pick that shit up, get it off my board.
Right.
Yes. But it's on you as the opponent to make that call.
Yeah, I just mean, like, yeah, they could pre-measure whatever they want, but at some point the clock has to start and they have to put their models down.
Yeah.
And then they have to move the model.
They would get a serious case of stink eye from me if that was happening.
I would just call the judge immediately. I'm just surprised that
heard of that. So
I've heard of it a couple of cases, but it's not common.
I've played against it, and it wasn't a problem because my opponent wasn't being a jerk about it. And, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyways, we're talking about widgets, not pre-measuring.
Yeah.
So basically the idea is to
This is how you go about the technological achieving of pre-measuring, or how you go about measuring in the game.
Yeah, basically the, you know, using widgets, having proxies on the table, and, you know, sort of opinion, because we all own a tremendous collection of widgets at this point, and, you know, which ones we find most useful if somebody's picking up a widget set or trying to figure out what they want to buy into if they don't have widgets already.
Yeah. It kind of becomes part of the game.
I can't remember.
We're almost, what, over 40 years collectively of playing War Machine?
Probably. Actually, Ben and I may be 35 ourselves.
No, we're 20 together.
Yeah.
Since Mark 1.
I guess that's true. 6 years. I started back when Minions just came out, fresh baby Minion player.
Yeah, well, I still remember.
Bright-eyed.
I'm gonna tell you my first widget story here. Long before anyone started making widgets, this was at Gen Con, probably year 3 of War Machine. There was a press ganger who made the first L-shape widget I'd ever seen.
One of these guys.
And I remember because I was sitting there, and I can't remember what tournament it was in. I think it may have been the very first hardcore they ever ran, when they the one where they gave out the t-shirts. But he had, and this was before laser cutters and CNC machines were super common, he had made a piece of the plastic. It was, the one I have is red, but it was an L that was 3 inches on one side, 2 inches on the lower side, and half an inch thick. And I remember at the time, this was a course when unicoherency Mark 1, you had to be within 3 inches of another member of the unit and all these other silly things.
It was funny, 40K and War Machine were like that. I had the like most dead eye 3-inch measurement.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I would be in with below an eighth of an inch just by eye.
And
I forgot about that.
I really wish I could remember the guy's name because he was a fantastic opponent to play into. But I remember I was playing into him and he was using this thing and I kept looking at it. And I'm like, that is just an amazing idea because people were using like little pieces of, I had wooden dowels with me. That's actually what I was using. I had a 3-inch dowel, which I had, you know, hand cut, and a 2-inch dowel. I mean, they were like 2-inch-ish, but it was good enough for what
Doing. I was tape measures for years and years and years.
And, well, it's because I was running a lot of Winter Guard, and you can't tape measure all that.
A friend of mine actually took, there were a couple of like, I don't know what you would call them, but they were like screwed together, like screws.
Oh, yeah, the
that,
1-inch, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that they were an inch, and you can make your own measurement sticks
but
out of them.
He was kind enough, because he had made some extras, and so after I played him, he was kind enough to give me one of those. And I still have it in my Cawdor set, and as soon as I got it, like, I never used anything else. Like, it was by far the most amazing thing. And that was back before they had the circles. They just had, like, the big pie plate templates, and that the original spray, which was the weird abbreviated spray. And ever since then, I remember when people started coming out with widgets, like I bought a bunch of sets. You know, I had the Broken Egg ones. I have the Muzan Mini ones. I have all the Privateer Press ones because I've gotten those over the years. And I have some other random ones. Oh, the Frozen Forge ones. I picked up a set of those, which actually are my favorite at the moment. And so everyone else has collected a ton of widgets over the years as well.
There's the spray template different sizes thing. You know, obviously the Mark 1 spray template is different sizes from the current ones, so don't use the Mark 1 one anymore. But some production runs of the... They have the different colored War Machine and Horde spray templates. Some runs of those are different sizes than each other. And all of them are different sizes from the one in the book. So
the new one or the old ones?
No, this was the old ones. But
be
very careful with spray
versions
templates.
Are all right sized, and they're all compatible. I actually had to go through my bag, and I compared them at one point, and I had to put a bunch of them aside because they were, in fact, not the right length. That is also a hint. I mean, most of the widget manufacturers these days are pretty accurate, but there used to be a real problem with 3 inches not being 3 inches for some of these people.
Some of my old ones, like some of the old bases I got, I think they're actually smaller than the actual base.
Actually, the Privateer Press bases did change slightly in size because I know that...
They changed manufacturers on
the... Right, they changed manufacturers, and the newer ones that have the logo imprinted on the bottom of the base are slightly larger, and I know because my board was exactly snug for the original bases.
And then they just...
And, they don't fit right.
Also, the metal Privateer bases, when they offered all-metal bases, those, because of shrinkage out of the mold process, are smaller than their size.
I forgot they had metal bases.
Yeah.
I love my metal bases.
So that's something to be aware of. I mean, in the rules specifically for base sizing, because, you know, even just different casting runs, there's variation in sizes for the plastic bases. This was at one point called out in the rule book, like 50 millimeters-ish is 50 millimeters. You know, if you're swapping back and forth between a proxy base or whatever, just treat it as effectively the same. Like, all my Titans, like, I'm on the third time my Scorn has been painted, so none of my bases are the right size.
It's not as bad. It's like, I don't know if any of you guys have looked at like the GW bases these days, but they are all over the place.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, but that's like over the history of manufacturing, there's been a bunch of size variations. You know, spray templates are spray templates. Test your spray template for size. Bases are bases, and as long as you're adhering more or less to the 50 millimeter standard, and as long as you and your opponent are like in alignment on that, it shouldn't be a problem. But
I mean, when we're talking about, I mean, obviously you have widgets and you have proxies, so I mean, well, your proxy bases can be both cutouts that a lot of these companies sell, which have the angle marks on them already, or you can just use a base and paint marks on it.
Why don't we get into the, like, you know, what's in your toolkit kind of thing, for, like, you know, what you have to have or what you should have as an aspiring competitive player or even as someone endeavoring to play the game of War Machine cleanly and accurately, what you should have in your toolkit of widgets and stuff
like
that.
So I'll list out, because I've actually recently edited mine, because I used to just carry everything with me, which became tedious and unnecessary.
Yeah, sure.
My current build out is I have two of each size base for proxying. And that's so whatever I'm doing, I can have position A and position B before I move the model. The idea being is, let's say I have something that is charging something and then has maybe overtake or some other post-movement
or
effect.
Or if you're attempting to move around another model,
right.
Like, this is how I get clear of their circumference, and then this is where I want to go to. Yeah. And you
right.
adjust, the, so just I always, adjust those two coordinates.
Right, so I always have at least two proxies for each size, and that's exactly what I have right now. I actually have three large bases, because proxying large bases because of the overhang with some of the model lines becomes more common.
Yeah, I was about to say, I actually like to have three or four at least of each size, because I like to have...
I have 4 to 10.
Right, but, yeah. I like to have the models sitting on the proxy base.
No.
If there's an argument, you can always go back to go, all right, he was here, I'm moving here, and like you can have different positions going
right
on.
Well, the way I normally do it is I never move the model. I always put the proxies first, and yeah. I've oftentimes done the entire activation without moving the model, with the understanding that the proxy is its final position, and then after everything's done, I actually take the model and place it where the proxy is.
I do that all the time with Sorsha. I'll measure out her activation, like, just do a couple of variations, like take my 6-inch widget, measure out where these proxy bases are going, get something I like, and say, would you agree that like all these things are within 12 inches of this location? And say, okay, without touching my model, leaving the proxy bases in place, Sorsha wind rushes to here, pops feet, gets these models, and then advances to where her current base is. Or something like that.
Yeah. And also it makes it simpler, because if I don't move the original model, if there's any contention over the activation or radiuses or anything, I always know where my start point is. So there's no contestion whether I had the overall distance or not. And I found that that's very helpful in a lot of the, like when you get to, you know, when you're 3-1 at the end of a tournament, people get really chippy about certain things. You're like, no, my model's still here. You said I couldn't get there. Here's my 10-inch widget. Hey, look, I'm within 9 inches. I got 10 inches of movement. Yeah. I got reach. You know, this, and it saves a lot of problems about people complaining.
Yeah, it's almost required once you get to like a semifinals or finals table, because that's going to happen. It's not malicious. It's just
right
when you're at that high in the tournament, people are going to start questioning everything. So you need all of those laid out so you can just easily go with
activations. Like it'll be a lifesaver, because you're like, well, wonder what this activation will do. Well, you move the models, so now you're dedicated in the
and also the nice thing about the plastic material proxies is that all the ones I have already have both the front point and the arcs marked. And for clarity, it's much simpler, because rather than worrying about the model facing, the proxy is exactly correct to the rules as far as its facing and its arc. Yeah. And that saves a lot of problems, especially if models have rules like Thresher or anything else. You can be like, no, he's pointing directly at the charge target. We know that. I can put a laser across that line and see exactly who and is and is not within the reach.
There's another gear. It's not quite a widget, but like, man, all your models just need their arcs marked.
Well, right, but some models, like, even if the arcs are marked properly,
Titans. Most,
yeah, I mean, even some of the Legion beasts, like, things just get weird with where the stuff is sticking. Even if you have stuff marked,
yeah,
it's not base super
overhang.
Simple. Yeah, and so the proxy base solves all of that, because it's just exactly clear. And that's why I like to do the full activation first, because it removes any of those questions. And, you know, it's fair to both me and the opponent, because sometimes, like, my vision of being able to nail multiple models doesn't actually work once I get to the base there. And then you're like, oh, I got to make a decision, which is fine. And then, in addition to the proxy bases, of course, you have widgets, which are all fixed-length measuring.
So, common ones, 2-inch, 3-inch, 5-inch, half-inch, and 2, 4, 6, 1. Do you have any other ones?
So, my favorite set right now is the one I got from Frozen Forge.
And Me too.
Yeah, because it has a 3-inch...
3-inch, half-inch.
3-inch, half-inch, 4-inch, 1-inch.
Yeah. The reposition stick and your 4-inch, 1-inch.
Because, you know, a lot of the sides have 3 inches on the L-shaped ones, but I found that just having the 3-inch stick, especially for line of sight into a forest, solves so many questions during a tournament because
it's unambiguous.
Right, because I'll place my model, put the 3-inch thing there, and make sure you can't see it. And then there's no question if somebody's putting the L shape and you have some slop, they're like, oh, I have this. You're like, no, this is 3 inches. And you can kind of push it around, and you're like, there's no way you can see. Or if there's 3 inches on a forest, but it's on a specific angle, you can then use the laser to see if you have line of sight.
Yeah.
And that's been a huge help in solving some of those issues for me.
I also want to throw out on the 3-inch, 1/2-inch specifically why I call it the reposition stick. This is just a measurement tip. You can do this with cavalry, or you can do this with reposition battle engines, or basically anything that has reposition. What you want to do is you lay down the proxy base. Like, you determine where it's moving to, and you put down a proxy base. You leave the proxy base on in place, and then put the model on top of it. It does its activation. You take your stick, you pick the model back up, and you put the stick touching the back edge of the base, or whatever edge is appropriate for where you're moving to. Like, this is where doing back edge to back edge measurement makes a lot of sense, is without touching the proxy base, you can touch your 3-inch stick to the back, put your model down as a proxy base, and measure 3 inches to the back of its base. That's precisely your reposition move. This is super convenient with battle engines. Always keep your wreck markers off your colossals, whatever. Put down the proxy base, put the battle engine on top of it, and then use the stick to just touch the back of its base and the wreck marker base, because the model will always be at least partially within its own base. It makes measuring that so much more accurate.
I was curious. I'm actually curious if I'm the only one that owns this widget amongst this group. I actually have a 3-inch charge widget, which is, it just goes around snugly around the base. Large, medium, and small, but it says specifically that you can get a 3-inch charge.
Those used to not be legal in the last edition.
Now they are pre-measuring.
Yep. It's glorious.
So I don't even remember what event it was. I won a set of those.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if I donated them as a prize support or if I still have them in a drawer somewhere. But I found that they caused almost as much confusion as they solved most of the time, because they have the two notches, right?
Yeah, you replace.
And so people would get really fussy with it in a way that if you just put down the 3-inch thing and moved it, they wouldn't.
Yeah, but the thing I enjoy about it is, like, if you run into those issues of, can this person make it past a jack and they're right next to it, you hand them the 3-inch charge, it is perfectly fit to the base. So you can get the laser, you get a nice laser line for where they can place. And it's also like, I've ran into issues where I've been unsure if a person could do a 3-inch charge, because that's like when it's really close and people are like, oh, I'm doing this, and like, can you? And so it's nice to be, can you just please check? You just hand them the widget and just be like, right, just to be sure.
There's one widget that I wish I had, but I don't own. Have you ever seen, I think they were cut out of really thin stainless steel, but they were the 3-inch cloud that had the one line with the base edge marked.
Yes,
they were great for trenchers.
Several of those in like resin.
Advanced deployment sells those.
Yeah. Those seem super nice. I haven't actually cared enough. But
so if it's a steel cut ring that's just marking the perimeter of it, that's probably better. The one Advanced Deployment sells is basically a solid thing of acrylic, so it can be somewhat unwieldy when trying to set it down if there are other models.
Yeah, this one was just
place.
Like super thin ring with just one line coming out with the base. Yeah. So you knew you were completely centered on the model.
That's becoming increasingly uncommon, though, especially because so many AoEs are centered on the model that drops them.
Right.
Oh,
but see, that's what kind of bugs me. Like, that's kind of a pet peeve of mine. People center things on models off by like a half of an inch to an inch, and it's always in their favor.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, it's centered and happened to touch this forest, but...
So, I don't remember most of them offhand, but, like, if you're a War Machine player, this is probably something you should devote some time to doing, is figure out how and where AoEs of different sizes are centered. So, for example, if you have the fuel cache objective, and you're trying to figure out where to drop the cloud so that the center's within 1 inch of the fuel cache, how you do it is you take the rim of your cloud and it touches the center of your objective's base.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's geometrically where it lives by, like, less than a millimeter. Because a 50 millimeter base is just under 2 inches. my gun carriage when I fire the 4-inch AoEs. I take my 10-inch spray. Oh, and this is another spray call out. The center of your 10-inch spray is longer than 10 inches. The sides are precisely 10 inches. Do not use the center for exactly 10 inches. Take my 10-inch spray, set it on its side, touch the 4-inch AoE to it. The center of that AoE is precisely 12 inches from my gun carriage. I can leave the AoE on the table, facing in the precisely the right orientation, and deviate it from there. Anything that's centered within a 1-inch, take a few minutes, do the math, make sure you can, you just know the distances and can drop it by hand easily and accurately. And, you know, your blast keys, that's another widget you should have in your kit, is blast keys based on the size of the AoE.
Oh, gosh.
And the different base sizes of the model. You touch it to the base. If it's centered, this is where the edge of the AoE is. You can use these to help you determine where your AoE is centered. So,
and
like,
diffuse about 6 minutes of argument with your opponent.
Yeah, so yeah. Trencher Clouds like Kodiaks. I have my Kodiak. It vents steam. I take the AoE. I touch the blast widget to the size of the ring I'm laying down around the Kodiak, off to one side, and then off to the front. Between those two measurements, the centering of that ring is perfect.
What also, the nice thing about the blast widgets is that if you directly hit a model, the blast widgets solve any sort of like reaching over the table and trying to stare at a ring, maybe centered, maybe not, because the blast widget's unambiguous.
You're not going to have parallax on that.
Right.
And also, if you can also use it instead of just strike offensively, you can also use it defensively as the person, if you're facing a force that has a lot of blast damage, you can just place that widget and see like, all right, if he does get a direct hit, how many things is he going to hit? Can I move these away from each other?
Right.
Yeah, good call on that.
Yeah, and your positioning is always perfect to avoid getting more than one guy hit.
When I was playing Texas, that was just like, I had that key in my hand all the time. Just like move, check, and then I would leave a few bunch together so the opponent thought they could do something with their blast, and then they still wouldn't kill them and I would laugh. But it was still...
Given that it will still deviate and probably hit some things, but it's better than taking a direct hit and losing things that you didn't need to.
Right. Guaranteed losing the one guy and potentially some other guys versus potentially losing some guys.
Right, and in higher value units rather than drudges, it actually matters a lot more, because you that way your opponent also understands that he's getting one target if he hits.
Yeah, there's also a widget I kind of wish I had. I remember seeing a Kickstarter for it, and I believe it got funded, but it was like a protractor key, but it was like 1-inch, so you could like walk it across the table and get like measurements.
Those are pretty sharp. This is actually why I like the Frozen Forge kit so much, is because it comes with the 4-inch, 1-inch. So it's 4 inches on one side and then 1 inch on the other. And you can do the same thing with it. Because it doesn't have the 2-3-5 half inch widget thing where it's really wide or ungainly on some sides. It's just 4 inches and 1 inch. So you can protractor walk it.
Yeah.
Quick mention, doing protractor walks. If you have a widget that's a given like length on a side and you want to measure precisely that movement, the best way to do it is actually, because the widget has some width to it, like pick the side of, you know, whether it's that quarter inch width or whatever that you're going to be measuring along, and leave the point that you're moving to stationary when you rotate your widget.
As far as lengths of measuring widgets, obviously a 3, a 4, and a 5 are crucial measurements to be able to check all the time.
Yep. And 6.
Yeah. And six. And then, of course, 10 is a, well, 8 and 10 are also super common as well.
Your 10 comes with your spray template.
Yes, I ended up getting one of the best buys I think I ever did was buying the 8-inch spray.
Oh, the old one?
No. The current one.
Oh,
From I think it was Broken Eggs, because I use 8 inches all the time for a ton of things. Mm-hmm. And before that, you know, I was either doing 6 and +2 or 10 -2. And then I just have an 8, and it just solves a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, I mean, it's not like you can't measure this with a measuring tape or something. This is all for obvious tournament play and clock issues, because you're trying to demonstrably accurately measure an activation with as little time off your clock as possible.
Clean play a game.
Right.
Yeah. And even if you take your measuring tape and like go through all the labor of getting it to, you know, alongside your model's base, you're still going to have parallax and you're still going to have to draw an imaginary line between the tape and the base. It's so much easier to take a piece of plastic and just touch things with it. Like,
That makes it in.
Yeah, that makes it so much more ambiguous, unambiguous, which is incredibly valuable.
Well, it's also nice, too, with pre-measuring to avoid threat radiuses, because I do this all the time where I'll move a model up and I'll normally, because I'm forgetful, I'll ask my opponent how far his things threaten and then try to, in my brain, confirm the right number and still get it wrong. But when I do get it right, I'll know that I need to be 11 inches from X, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I can't do anything useful by getting closer, I'll make sure everything I have is 11, you know, 0.8 inches away from the models that threaten them. And that
you take the widgets, you make them touch, and then you scoot.
Right. And that way, both my opponent and I know that his next activation, he's going to have to use something other than advancing and shooting that unit or charging them.
We want to move on to terrain.
One quick call out on measuring and accurately measuring with all these tools you have. In circumnavigating any obstacle, whether it be a model, a terrain piece, etc., even if you have perfectly accurate sticks, you can't just lay the sticks end to end to give you an accurate measurement that isn't in a straight line. If you are doing any kind of circumnavigation at any time where you take a turn, in order to make a legal measurement, there needs to be a base there to represent your endpoint. You need to make sure that there are no collisions, and then you place your next destination. Models' bases have widths, and if you're attempting to circumnavigate something without, you know, just on the linear vector, you're not accounting for the width of your model's base.
And you're going to go a lot shorter distance than you think you are if you're not accounting for that, because
exactly.
The turns take movement.
Exactly. And I've seen, even at top level tables, even at the War Machine Weekend Invitational, I have seen people do this wrong. It is not a legal measurement. Do not do it. Put bases down.
Another thing I'll call out, which is something that I see a lot, is that if you have a cloud creation effect in your army, always have twice as many as you need, because a lot of times you'll have models in the cloud and rather than taking
they can't
up
physically move
or it's just too disruptive to the game state to pull the cloud effect from underneath everything, to have another set of those clouds so that you can recreate states and then pull off the cloud so you don't have to disturb anything. Because a lot of times things that create clouds will move and create the cloud or whatever. And so you always want, in my opinion, to have twice as many of those AoE effects as you require for a given turn. So that way you never have to be in a position where you have to pull out and disrupt model placement.
I would also say opponent consent is very important when you're doing all these measurements. Like,
yeah, and just talk
communication
through
it is important. Yeah, tell them it's your turn. They can't do anything on your turn aside from countercharge or like arcane vortex. So tell them, I'm moving my caster here to try to kill this model. Do you agree that I can move here? I'm placing the proxy. Do you agree that I have range to this? Yes. Good. Make sure that they agree to the movements, because even if you're accurate with your proxy basis, what you have to watch out for with pre-measuring is that they agree to all of these.
Yeah. Sometimes people don't know what your models do.
Yeah.
So you need to accurately let them know, even if it's
I've like seen people do this all the time. They take their tape and kind of sweep it around and they move there and they're like, and now I shoot. And I'm like, well, you swept it over there and you weren't in range, but you didn't tell me like what you were doing. I thought you were trying to stay out of your control area. So sorry, man.
Yeah, and people are generally fairly cooperative if you take the course of being disclosive and you're just like, I think I'm going to try and kill you this turn. I'm going to take some measurements to see if I can kill you.
Yeah.
Is this in range to do this thing? And you make a bunch of measurements and you get your opponent to agree. And like, no, this isn't in range. Okay, I'm not going to try and kill you. Or yes, I'm going to try and kill you. And they're going to be like, come at me, bro. And then they're stationary and it works. But
and if you are getting flack, I mean, this is all legal in a tournament. If someone's not helping you with that, just call a judge immediately. Like, you need someone there to confirm your measurements.
And if
it's a friendly game, it's not very
well,
friendly.
And that's
anymore.
Why I always like using the proxies and leaving the model in its original place, especially for key runs like that. Because I've had that happen a number of times where, you know, I'll start moving, you know, depending on the caster, obviously, either my key heavy or the caster itself. And by leaving it there and using the proxy, if a judge has to be called over, there's zero concern about the correct state of the game, because I can be like, my caster is still technically in the start spot. This proxy base is here. Can you confirm yes or no? on this line of sight, and they'll either say yes or no, and I'll be like, well, in that case, then I need to reshift this.
Yeah, I would also say don't be afraid to call a judge over to do it or to do the measurements, or if you think that a proxy base is a little wrong or that you're like, don't be afraid to call a judge. I mean, they're there to do that for you, because like sometimes you can get into those arguments with an opponent.
And you don't want to be in that argument.
No,
just
because
call
then
the judge.
It ruins the rest of the game.
By that point, both players have lost. Like, one player may still ostensibly win the game, but everyone's lost.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, no matter how tight the competition, you know, I always want to walk away from a win or a loss, you know, feeling that it was rightly earned rather than, you know, some cheesy, like, oh, this whole thing got scuppered and then he got a kill run that shouldn't have been there, or I got a kill run that shouldn't have been there.
Yeah, you always want your games to be impeccable and above reproach.
Yeah.
It's exactly it. That's why we have widgets.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just want to win my games.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would do better if I never had to roll anything. And then my widgets would lead the way to victory.
Yeah.
Play Wormwood. You rarely have to roll any dice.
You know, you still have to roll dice, though.
So speaking of the tree, that's a good segue off of Wormwood.
Oh, to terrain.
So the second part, which of course goes with widgeting, is terrain on tabletops. And this is sort of one of those things where I've been wargaming for longer than I'd want to admit publicly, but I come from...
I was 10 years old when I started, and that's still less than you've been wargaming.
It's one of those things
where... I
think
I was 8, and I may be tied.
It was one of those things where I've always enjoyed making terrain. It's actually part of one of the few parts of the painting hobby that I like, and it had a lot to do with... a good friend of mine, his father made model railway kits and sets and huge elaborate things. And that's actually one of the things that drew me into miniature gaming originally. And you know, it's pretty common for people of my age group that the railway hobby kind of was the gateway drug to miniature gaming. And, you know, I've built 40K cities. I've built really elaborate set piece boards before. And so for me, having three-dimensional terrain on the table is something I actually enjoy. And I've noticed, especially it's accelerated with Mark III, it feels that
the advent of the two-dimensional terrain.
The two-dimensional terrain, and I mean, I get the convenience of it, don't get me wrong. I think it is phenomenally convenient.
It's also more accurate.
To have the fat mat plus two-dimensional terrain is a very fast, very space-efficient, easy way to play the game. And I'm not...
It also makes the game
more
portable. You don't have to be at the game store. You can just
go over to your buddy's place, roll it on the floor, throw some things, and go.
But I feel like that tendency, because the fat mat, I don't think, is negative at all. Because I think having a
I think that's a straight improvement.
Right, that's a straight improvement. But it's the 2D terrain that makes me sort of feel like I'm missing something. Because I agree there's more terrible hills in the miniature world than there ever should have been made. But there's a lot of... the feeling of the miniature game that seems to disappear when everything's flat, like the walls are flat, the trenches are flat, the forest things are flat, the buildings are flat, the hills are flat. And pretty soon it feels like you're sort of basically playing a board game at that point rather than a miniatures game.
Sure.
And I feel as effective as the terrain is for portability, and having run tournaments at conventions, I have to say that the flat terrain logistically is a godsend. But it feels like part of it's kind of gone away.
Yeah.
So, go for it.
I actually I've felt that same way. It was down in Kingdom Con where most of the table terrain was pretty flat. It made for great tournament play. But also at Kingdom Con, they have some of the most gorgeous 40K tables I have ever seen. And sometimes I would peruse over there and look at the 40K tables and ask myself, why can't I play War Machine on this table? Because it looks so cool.
Yeah. The eye-catching factor is a big thing. Like, the verisimilitude and the simulation and feeling really, like, psychically immersed in your game is one of the big upsides of 3D terrain. And it's totally awesome. And one of the biggest things that many wargaming communities struggle with is recruitment. You basically depend on consistent new blood to account for player churn, to keep your community growing, to up the scale of your competition, all these things. Like, only a fraction of your people will be competitive. You need recruitment, and to do that, your game needs to be eye-catching, immersing, all these things. 2D terrain can kind of crimp that a lot.
I think you can just switch it by types, too. I think the buildings are completely egregious. Like, there's no reason a building can't be 3D.
Well, so this, yes.
Because you can't walk in it. It's supposed to take up space on the board.
Walls as well. This is my rejoinder is I love 2D terrain for a lot of reasons. I 100% agree with you. Walls and obstructions should be 3D because the form of having a physical game piece that models can't stand on reinforces the legal position of models can't stand on this. You can't physically fit them here. Job done. And like the broken egg 2D walls are a giant pain in the ass because you can stand on them and it gets to be really hard to position around them. And the art print has a shadow on it, which makes even measuring that highly ambiguous.
And I've seen like models get bumped on that 2D terrain where you look down at the board and I'm like, huh, your model's an eighth of an inch on top of that wall. So what are we going to do with that now? There's just those two to me almost should be 3D.
Agreed.
For the same reason a hill should be 2D. Because a hill is just too awkward to have models.
Yeah, I
balancing.
Agree. Actually, the only thing, the hills and the forests are the only thing I don't mind in 2D, to be honest, because everything else I feel should be 3D. Yeah. But the hills and the forests, I mean, the forest turned into kidney bean-shaped templates a long time ago anyways.
Yeah.
And you can still throw a 3D tree on top of it.
Yeah, and that's what
inclined.
That's what I think
yeah,
it should
putting,
be.
Right. Putting 3D features
on them. But just aesthetically.
Right. And, you know, I will say that Broken Egg, and there's a couple other companies that make really amazing looking, almost flat water features. Which,
those are fantastic. Because water features, just by definition, almost they have to almost be negatively small.
Right. and I like those because they look great but don't impede the game state at all. But yeah, the flat 2D, I remember this was Celesticon, which didn't take place this year, unfortunately, but in previous years, where we were trying to draw in discontented Warhammer Fantasy and 40K players. And they would glance over at our tables and they'd be like, what are you guys playing? Is that a miniature game? Because the tables were just super boring looking. And it was one of those things where only when I looked around it, I realized like how really uninteresting the game looked to a passerby. Because even if the figures were nicely painted, in a lot of cases, you know, both of the armies were painted and they were playing. And, you know, people were obviously in a very intense game, but you just had this sort of patchwork of flatty things. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't very interesting to walk by and look at.
There was a couple of times where I got to play on some really cool tables, and it was a War Machine game, and I got to make use of all the rules in Mark II. We basically built up a paper city. It was like the Malifaux set.
Mm-hmm.
And we built a city, and we played a game of War Machine on it. It was so much fun. Like, I literally had a Roadhog, like, beat down a wall so my forces could go through it and adjust the terrain. It was amazing. And I even played a couple of games when I was at Gen Con on the dynamic tables or their...
Oh, yeah, their set piece tables.
Their set piece tables.
Oh, those are beautiful.
Oh, it's so much fun, like, when you can play on that. And it's reminiscent of the tables that 40K had.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that, for some reason, and it's also because of how the game's set up and the way of scenarios working. Scenarios have to have an evolving table.
It's a much more technical game. So for a lot of these reasons, you do need the 2D to make it truly like position forward instead of artistic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So one thing I will say, 2D forest, 2D water are a godsend. Even like the two-dimensional buildings that Muzon Minis and Broken Egg are doing, the ones where they're wrecked are great for rubble terrain, which is like cover forests.
Yeah. But even that you could...
Well, so, like aesthetically, so for me, dressing them up, you put trees and you put like broken building shit that's removable on the piece, and it's magnificent. And like this is what Tyson and Will did at Phoenix Open. And those were really good looking boards for using almost all 2D terrain or the terrain that they had in their long established con kit. The one problem piece of terrain in which I wholly endorse being 2D, but which is aesthetically unsatisfying at 2D is hills.
Mm-hmm.
because hills in either Mark II or Mark III, in which I think they're more counterintuitive now, but hills are always binary. Hills as a terrain piece need to be visually identifiable as binary. Like, on or off needs to be a snap visual decision without impairing the play state. The 2D hills are great for this. And the 3D hills that I've seen that are good for this are step hills, but you absolutely need pieces of foam or something to keep models standing.
And aesthetically, they still don't look great. It looks like there's just a weird mesa in the middle of your board.
Sloping hills are absolutely one of the worst possible things
for
gameplay.
Those kill paint jobs.
If you are a TO...
I hate sloping hills
more than anything. If you're a TO, never, ever, ever, ever use sloping hills. This goes for you too, Privateer Press. Sloping hills cause models to topple off. They cause all kinds of damage to your minis. And the worst thing, if you think about the geometry at all, sloping hills cause you to lose your mind. The model's base tilts. Its profile in the shape of the game, which is defined two-dimensionally, becomes an ellipse rather than a circle.
Oh, this is how cones work.
This is a giant problem. This should never, ever occur in your two-dimensionally defined game for any reason. Do not use sloping hills. Ever. As good as they look, do not ever use them.
What I also love is how Privateer Press's tournament kit has sloping hills. And they're a company that makes the most top-heavy models I have ever seen.
I know. It blows my mind. It's remarkable that back when Lock and Load started, they had one of the best terrain kits of any convention going for their regular workaday builds. Because they had the nice textured mats, and now they've moved on to fat mats, which are fantastic. And they had all this wonderfully rendered resin terrain. And then as the conventions went over time, they got better and better looking 2D kits. They got terrain kits that were more uniform. Now Lock and Load and the Privateer Press kit is like lagging remarkably behind the times.
I was actually going to say, coming off of your Tyson comment, is I think Tyson makes some of the best terrain cinematic tables that are also
they're gorgeous,
and they provide really challenging dynamics and manage to be really thematic,
but you still get all the things that are on the table to play a cut and dry tournament game. You don't lose out on, just because it's a cinematic table, it's not going to make you play any differently.
Yeah,
and they're gorgeous, and I think that it can be done. It takes a lot of work, but also like 40K tables took a lot of work.
Yeah.
I would say the Lock and Load table this year was really good too. Or was it last year?
The finals table where it was the urban city and they had the scenarios.
That was brilliant.
Yeah.
That was really well.
Yeah, all the Privateer Press set piece tables I think are as good as anything I've ever seen. And the fact that they let you play on them, I really appreciate, because at Lock and Load and at Gen Con over the years, like, I played a bunch of fantastic games on the set piece stuff, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's just more the general tournament, because it is frustrating to go to these tournaments and, you know, everything is precise in the 2D, but, you know, you kind of look down the row and it just feels very uninspiring.
A little sad.
Right. Because you just see figures in different places and you don't feel like any sort of immersion. And then you go next door to look at a different game. And this was really very true at Adepticon this year, where I'd go from the War Machine Hordes room and I go right next door to the
Infinity room where I got drunk.
Oh, God, not everything.
No, Infinity jumped in my mind.
Not even the Infinity room. What's that Viking game?
Oh, Saga.
Saga. And you go look at the Saga tables, and like each table told a story. It was brilliantly done. And I would just feel sad because I'd look at those tables and I'm like, oh, that's so cool. It's like a Anglo-Saxon village or like a beach landing or all these things. And you go back to the other room and you're like, wow, just flat mats and little pieces of felt.
All right. So if you had to make a change to up the eye-catching appeal of War Machine tables while maintaining playability, how would you do it? Like, you were building, you're a minis coordinator or the War Machine event go-to guy at a convention. How do you do it for War Machine tables?
What I would do is that I would pick, I mean, of course, a lot of this depends on how many total seats you're trying to fill. Because if you're trying to do, you know, like 16 tables, it's a lot easier than doing 100 tables. Mm-hmm. But just to have thematic terrain like Privateer Press used to do, like the resin pieces I thought were brilliant, because they used to have really great, like their shallow terrain, their trenches, all that stuff was really thematic. It was flat enough so that it didn't interfere with the game, but it looked good on the table.
Their trenches, actually, just to touch on briefly, I think are really important. That's the one thing we didn't talk about. But
yeah,
the 3D trenches don't really affect movement, and they're really good because you have to be inside the trench. That's another problem with the 2D trenches.
Yeah.
Is there's a lot of argument. Did you mean to be in that trench because your base is overhanging? But with a 3D, like this line, you have to fit in the trench and you can't cheat. Because this happens a lot.
I believe that changed actually in the Mark III edition, that if it's a trench template, it's the whole thing now.
It varies by turn. That's the other issue.
Whatever you and your opponent agree on.
Right. So Joran down in Santa Clara makes the best 3D trenches in the market. 2.5D, I guess. Trenches with actual extensible dimensions, but are flat enough to be tournament usable. And they're basically made out of coffee stirrers. We'll have to take some photos tomorrow.
I have to say that the Privateer Press trench kit is excellent.
Joran's kit is even flatter than that, which is really impressive. I mean,
I have that kit, and I'm really happy with it.
Oh, like, no,
it's great. They nailed it, in my opinion, as far as the best trenches I've seen that are flat and usable.
And look good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they paint them really easy, too. Even I painted mine.
Yeah, I still like the Muse kit, but yeah, it's as a 2.5D trench where you have extensible like vertical dimensions where your model is in or not in just by like touch feel, they're great. But so improving a con tournament kit for terrain.
I mean, I would just make as much as possible 3D because you can make forest templates. You know, obviously they're going to be the kidney bean looking thing. Just have some trees so that. You know, I know everybody moves them off the template as soon as they start playing, but at least in between games, you have the appearance, like there's trees on the table. Mm-hmm. More buildings, obviously, just because they look appropriate and you can really theme the board. Like if you're looking down a row and there's more buildings, you can tell what game it is. Because one thing that's, Malifaux does that really well, Infinity, yeah. Of course, to an nth degree. You know, you can glance over and you're like, oh, hey, look, they're playing Malifaux, or yeah. Oh, hey, look, they're playing Infinity. With War Machine, you see a bunch of flat mats and you're like, mouse pads. Oh, that's probably War Machine.
Maybe. 2014, it was trenches. 2015, it was water features. 2016, the underplayed terrain feature is obstructions. Play more obstructions on your boards.
And those weird sludge pit terrain. No one's playing that either.
Or the those. Flaming forest or the fog
bank. I'll even say, for competitive reasons, I actually like those. The only one that I would like to see stay the same or change would be the cloud.
Yeah.
The cloud, if the cloud stayed on the table and was just a cloud
forever,
then Kane 2
and Sloan.
Actually, if they just drifted, that would be more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think somebody said, like, talked about, like, it's a feature that just drifts. It moves a certain distance and it drifts.
Ooh, we could roll deviation and have them scatter and all move the same direction.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Based on wind direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe, like, going off of, like, the kit idea, maybe it would be cool if they had, say, you were playing a city, in a city, like, you have to have a certain number of buildings, maybe some fences and some clouds, because of, like, the mist and everything. It's something that I think is, like, when they released the new kit for terrain features, they didn't have, like, a scenario set, and I think that's something that's coming out soon. Mm-hmm. I believe specifically for, like, there's no way to destroy a building anymore.
Yeah, that, and I think that's something we also talked about is terrain maps. I'd love to see that for tournaments, just like a list of here are your scenarios that you play and here are the maps of terrain.
And you can even do that as an event organizer,
right?
Yeah.
It's like all these tables are set up like this.
Just run your masters, pre-inform people. These are the 9 configurations or 6 configurations or 4 configurations that your boards will be in.
You don't even have to worry about the configurations. The whole limiting, like, there will be always 5 buildings on this table, 2 clouds, and maybe 2 walls, give or take. It sets up, this is going to be a thematic table. But it's going to be a competitive table. Play around it.
So my
The homogeneity isn't necessary. Like almost every tournament table you go to, it has a forest, a hill, a wall, obstruction,
yeah.
and water.
Yeah.
And then whatever two other features like they could find.
Throw three buildings on the table. Strike Force have been fixed. They don't shoot through buildings too much anymore. Well, Phantom Seeker's a problem, but...
Yeah. They shoot through them, but they don't ignore the cover.
Yes.
Yeah, they shoot through them, but they don't shoot through them.
Yeah, yeah, and I will say that is definitely a complaint a lot of tournaments is that the tables are way too similar. Like, they're identical in every case. And I think it removes...
I don't think that's an inherent fault in them, but I think it's something that aesthetically you have to grapple with.
Well, but I think it'd also be better to actually mix up the mix, because if you were... Because you can also force your players, if you're doing the tournament organizer, to make sure they're not playing on the same table over and over. And it does change up how an army plays. Like, if there's more buildings and no forests, for example, it changes the dynamic of a lot of armies.
Or so, that you play in a forest village where there's, like, four forests and maybe a building and an obstruction, a couple of obstructions.
So the thing about terrain, and in the previous edition, it was possible to have really interesting terrain-rich boards, which were poorly balanced game boards, for factors that were outside your control as an EO, namely Legion. Which one is the Legion player playing on, because they ignore most of the terrain, it doesn't matter to them, and it matters to their opponent.
Oh, they don't ignore it, they abuse it, which is even worse.
Right, like... yeah. Eyeless Sight has been toned down, most of these abilities have been toned down, but the problem still hasn't gone away, because these kinds of boards still disproportionately favor armies that can create line-of-sight blocking terrain en masse, especially if it doesn't have to be centered on a model. So, I mean, that's like literally the hardest thing to be cognizant of as an EO setting out a board, is that some armies, if you plop down 2-3-inch AoEs, totally throw the dynamic you thought this board would have.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said. I'm not sure if it's right or not, but I think terrain is still just a little too big an area most of the time.
I'd agree with you. I think like 16 square inches is maybe the upper limit.
Yeah.
That you'd want
like to
have
see
anymore.
A bunch more terrain, but much smaller, where it's not really anything bigger than 4 inches in any direction is probably too big for terrain.
Yep. Except for maybe forests if they're thinner. But yeah.
Yeah.
I'm kind of weird. I like a lot of terrain on the table. I like being disruptive to my plan and my opponent's plan, because it's like, how are you going to get around this?
Yeah.
Well, some people, like, the answer is wild growth.
That's what I always worry about. Like, the 6-inch, like, I've been switching the circle a lot more. And if I ever see a forest 6 inches across, I'm just like, oh, I can deliver my whole army up to that point trivially.
Yeah.
Because my forest wall is now, you know, 12 inches. It's like way better than a cloud wall that people are working hard to make.
But I mean, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, you take advantage of the terrain. Is it your fault that you took advantage of the terrain, or is it your opponent's fault that they didn't figure out to take advantage of it in that way? I mean, there's a dice roll for a reason. If you decide to go first and he's like, well, I'm not going to let you have that benefit.
Right.
I'm going to take that side from you. I had that happen to me with a Morvana 2 player. I gave him a forest on his side and near his deployment zone, and the rest of the game were just regrets.
Yeah,
that happened to me the last time I played Ryan in the tournament. I didn't internalize that I gave him a building for some
Sloan
reason.
Sloan loved that house.
Yeah.
What am I going to kill this turn?
Yeah.
Now I'll go back inside and make me a sandwich.
Yeah. That failure to articulate that building was there in my head cost me the game.
That's actually one of the most important terrain considerations for EOs and people setting out boards too, is how does this affect overall dynamic? Like, that's kind of encapsulated in the terrain creating, terrain ignoring. It's, how does this piece of terrain affect caster placement? Does it make a caster who lives here perfectly safe in all circumstances?
Yeah. And going back to talking about, I know a lot of people don't like the toxic pool or the burning forest. Maybe if they took the randomness factor off of those.
And just made them constant?
Well, not just constant, but by turn 3, it goes away.
Mm.
Like, you have a specific turn, both opponents know when that's going to go away. It's not unpredictable.
I'm sorry. I haven't really played with them much. What's the...
So the toxic pools...
So it's forests that inflict fire if you enter them, mm-hmm. and water features that inflict corrosion if you
just
enter
all
them.
All the time, right?
Yeah.
Oh, but...
Except at the start of each player's turn, you roll a die and on a 1 or a 2. The terrain stops doing that.
Oh, okay.
It's completely unpredictable.
It's because totally tacked on. Yeah. Like, you can see the staples in the rule book where they put this passage in.
Yeah, yeah. So I will say, though, that at one of the tournaments at Gamescape, they removed it going away, which I thought was fine.
Yeah.
So the toxic pool was just always toxic, and the burning... Well, they had burning tires because that's the terrain they were using. But the burning forest, it was actually pretty funny because these were all...
Did it also create cloud effect?
The burning forest didn't actually stop burning. And so I actually thought that was fine because you just knew that you're like, well, there was one army there that liked the burning forest and everybody else was like, hmm. And basically the toxic pool just became a thing where you could run a heavy through it and didn't care.
Right.
But everyone else was like, ooh, wow,
well,
that's a problem.
The toxic pool is basically an irrelevant terrain feature except for single wound infantry. Both of these mostly matter to single wound infantry.
Yeah. Right.
And they're kind of hitting the worst equipped models in the new edition.
Right.
Which is bizarre.
More relevant because there's a lot of it. Pathfinder infantry that wants to abuse a forest, like Alton Ashley with a forest and Alton Ashley with a burning forest are going to be
two different things.
Very different.
Well, so as far as these terrain pieces going away or staying or whatever, I think our experience at Game Castle recently was illustrative, where they had the fog banks, but each player would take turns removing them after a certain point. The unfortunate thing about fog banks as they exist now, burning forests as they exist now, and corrosive pools as they exist now, is they create standoff situations where one or more players is just pitched up at the edge of this thing waiting for it to go away.
Yeah.
And when it goes away, it confers some advantage on somebody. And the obvious problem with the core rules as written is it's random. If you put a timer on it and make it dependable, your game starts to lurch.
Yeah,
but it lurches predictably.
My favorite rule.
Literally any way you do it, it's a problem. And I think if it's permanent, it creates these lurches, but they never go away. So you get into like kind of standoff chicken.
Fog bank is the only one that's really weird because the burning forest.
Also because it's a cloud effect and so many things still ignore that.
Right, because the burning forest and the acid pool are just a thing, and basically they essentially become an obstacle for most pieces.
And if they never went away, you would just play them differently. You wouldn't stand off. You would just use it like anything else.
Right, and I think, you know, like I said, when we did the house rule where they didn't go away, you just took that into account. And, you know, sometimes you'd be like, well, my heavy's going through there and it's going to take a point, whatever. The cloud one was always the weirdest because there are plenty of armies that just frankly ignore it.
Yeah.
And
even if you didn't ignore it, why would you ever want to depend on, a line of sight blocker that may not block line of sight.
Right.
When you
and so yeah, the cloud ones are the ones that I disliked the most because they were the most mechanically ineffective because they really helped armies that ignored them and they really hurt armies that didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. Weirdly, as something that was, and I'm speaking to the Game Castle one here where players got to remove them in sequence after a certain point where they weren't random. They were originally intended to stop gun lines, but the problem was it wound up enabling the
Didn't
two
work.
Most egregious standoff gun lines in the army. You got Kane 2
and Sloan.
Lilith 3. So three.
Yeah, I laughed.
Three of
every
the
time
most egregious, like high offense shooting armies that literally don't care. It makes them stronger because their opponent can't retaliate.
And Assyria, by the way. I think we all came to that tournament just to abuse those.
Yeah. But the forest and the slimy pools don't change mechanically. So, I mean, other than, you know, catching on fire when you go into the forest.
I guess my worry is that they asymmetrically affect some armies.
But not to the same degree that a cloud effect does.
I can totally see a troll player just taking fire eaters and running them through the burning forest.
Hooray! This is the best terrain!
It's true. Well, you could just make it so the burning fire, the forest only sets you on fire like half the time. You could just roll it.
Oh, that's even worse.
Oh, that's better.
That's more die rolls.
I love more die rolls.
I hate the design. We don't know if this is too good or not, so we're just going to make a D6.
Yeah, it's like you're the designer. It's your job to pick. pick the value.
That's why I think like forest should be on the second player, like pools or forests. They should go out on the second player's like third turn.
Well, I mean, what you're doing, though, there is effectively gatekeeping infantry. You're not stopping them. You're just setting, like, a gate, and they wait until the gate's up.
Yeah. Or you take the risk and go through it.
I'm not saying that's inherently wrong. I'm just saying that's what you're doing.
I mean, but it's better than random predictability.
All right.
That's terrain.
Thank you for listening to Dominate for Two. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Got a question or an episode idea? Email us at dominateforto.podcast@gmail.com.
We sound so broken.
Comes in 2D or 3D.
It comes in flaming and acidifying.
And sometimes misty.
I would.
Oh, you know what they need is they need burning acidic fog.
They need freezing hills.
See,
if you go on the hill, you're stationary.
I just solved the meta.
Well,
it's perfect.
The more things you give me that are corrosive, the more things that push me towards croak raiders again. Because I can just stand in that and never die.
That's true. We'll make an exception, though, because it's burning
fog.
Corrosion.
Flaming fog.
This is how you get an all-protectorate meta.
Yeah, maybe you could set the acid on fire.
It combusts.
Oh,
you could have gasoline fume clouds.
Oh, that'd be awesome. So it produces a cloud effect. It's still water-ish. And it's on fire at the same time.
Yeah, that would be interesting if you had to, like, for the flaming forest, you had to hit it with a fire attack first. You had to, like, drift a fire AoE or spray it or something before it
lit. But it's still a cloud, so Sloane and Kane still ignore it. You could call the event Bullets from the Bullet Farm and Gas from Gas Town.
I mean,
nothing wrong with that.
I think some of the Mark One stuff, terrain features that were part of scenario pieces, were some like I know people hated them, but there were some of the creative ones. Like I think there was like
electrical
fern that like when it got hit or something died beside it, it would shoot lightning at something.
That's a super duper 40k-ism, by the way.
Yeah.
Because GW stopped designing their own terrain packets and all these things. And individual EOs started making their own packets with crazy terrain rules and all these things to balance out whatever the perceived thing of the day was. So you totally saw that.
Yeah. I always enjoyed the devouring forests.
I miss ambles. Ambles were the best.
Ambles?
Oh, yeah. You don't remember ambles?
Do you want to?
So in original 40K, ambles were
is this... The original 40K also had the desert clams that could be part of your army.
Oh, yeah. No, this is
clams
the same era.
That
were
in
the
sand, and they would eat people.
No, so the ambles were based... They had rules for having an amble pit, and they were like these weird ogre insect-faced things, right?
It's like brambles without the BR.
And they were like ant bulls, I think is what they were going for, ambles. But they would randomly emerge from this pit and attack... things at random. Like they would scatter dice around the table and attack things. It was the best.
I love like in all consensus, I would hate this on a competitive table. But on a casual fun table, I've always loved it. I even remember playing fantasy and we would have roll up the Deadly Forest. And somebody will walk into the Deadly Forest and on a 6, you're poisoned, so we always just considered that rabid squirrels just attacked you randomly by walking through their forest.
Oh no, someone brought acorns in their pouch again. We're done for.
Did you guys ever read Name of the Wind?
Yes.
Oh,
The stupid eternal raccoon in the tree. That's just what happens to everybody.
God. So I think that's...
Patrick Rothfuss has an unlimited capacity to jump up his own ass.
That's a weird way to finish our
I think
wrong.
We're cutting it earlier than all of this stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll cut out long before.